Welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in organizations, society, and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a design leadership coach, service design innovation consultant, educator, and writer. My apologies for the late start. We had both some tech problems and also the city have decided to cut down a tree just outside my window. So I will be kind of hitting mute judiciously throughout the interview to try and hope that you're not going to hear that. There it is. So while every app is rushing to add an AI assistant and kind of add AI this and everything will help you write your, you know, on LinkedIn, you can go online and start to write a post and AI is like, you know, would you like me to write your thought leadership for you? My guest today, Oliver Reichenstein, says, why should I bother reading what you haven't written? Oliver is the founder of Information Architects at the company behind the very popular Markdown-based writing app, IA Writer, and more recently, IA Presenter. He's here to talk about keeping it real when writing with AI and why and how they built in this authorship mode into IA Writer. Oliver, welcome to Power of 10.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So it's been an age since we actually kind of chatted person to person. I can't remember. We met many years ago at a conference and hung out. Our two families hung out together. And obviously, I've seen IA Writer evolve over the years. One of the first apps that I used on the mobile space, actually, I think is probably where I first started using it as kind of the iPhone came out and plain text was a thing and Markdown was a thing before you could kind of really do anything more interesting. So first of all, before we sort of get into the latest bit, how has it evolved over the years for you and how many years has it been?
It's been 13 years now. The idea is very, very old. I used to earn my money as a teacher of Microsoft products, Microsoft Office, and in particular, Microsoft Word, where my job was to teach people how to use Word, in particular to write scientific papers, you know, for university or for high-level schools. And I used to teach at Art School Basel. And I noticed there that the art school pupils had a similar problem as I had, where instead of writing, they were just, you know, choosing fonts and colors and line heights. And you know, by the time they were done with the right layout, the lesson was over. And of course, that was bothering me as a teacher. But I noticed that I had a similar pattern. Like every time I open Word, I first have to make sure that everything is correct before I get started. And so at the time, I started using a typewriter myself to see, you know, how that compares to Word. And I found that I write much better with a typewriter, even though it's very bothersome when you make a mistake and all that. But I found the way it slows you down, The fact that it hurts when you type, that you think twice before just typing anything because you can correct it later, actually led to a much better writing, just simply because I was thinking before moving my fingers. And so that idea was born in the 90s somewhere, mid 90s, but I always carried it with me. And by the end of the 0 years or the noughties, maybe I think they're called in English. I'm not quite sure.
They do. We say the noughties. Yeah.
You know, it sounds nasty, but yeah.
It's because, well, you know, it's the English people.
It's funny,
Andra,
right?
You know.
Yeah. By the end of around 07, we started to make concepts of an electronic device that we wanted to build in China by ourselves. Was half serious to serious, but I started to work with a Finnish designer that used to work for NASA, the toilets. Fits
the toilets.
The toilets for spaceships, because Americans didn't like making toilets, it's dirty. So they got the Finnish guy that had no experience with anything space. But yeah, he's a funny guy. He lived in Japan. And we worked together on a concept for an electronic device, an actual device where you could only write. And then the iPad came out and things happened very quickly. Yeah. We were lucky to get one of those iPads early on because we were working for Süddeutsche Zeitung and Die Zeit. And, you know, the moment where Steve Jobs presented the iPad, you know, we were on the job. So we were prepared with the design conditions of the iPad. At first, we printed out paper iPads and, you know, moved little boxes and pieces of paper on top of it. And then when I think in May, we got the first iPad at the office, you know, we had a little head start because I think it came out. I don't remember exactly when it came out, but we were really, the timing was perfect for our app. And yeah, we had a couple of good ideas from the very start. I think we came out with focus mode, the idea of focusing on one sentence at the time.
Mm-hmm. Like a typewriter, right?
Like a typewriter, exactly. That's what, it was really a translation of the typewriter, what we've done.
Yeah.
But we also said it's silly to just force people to write like on a typewriter where you can't edit because that wouldn't be medium appropriate. So
yeah.
It's a basic design principle that we follow in everything. We look at what does that, what we do now, mean in the physical world and how does it translate? How can we improve? It had reading time and, you know, we spent a lot of time on the typography of it. As we always do, and we started thinking about something called reading typography, where we discern the writing from the reading typography. I think it's a new thing on computers, because before you didn't have much choice on a typewriter what kind of typography you use.
Yeah.
And we found that actually monospaced fonts had a lot of benefits. I'm not going to get into each and every point there, but that's where we started. And the vision was always the same: to create a writing app that is made for writing.
Yeah.
Because Word is not like that. Word is the default writing app, but it's more like of a layout thing, but you can do this and that and versioning and all kinds of stuff. It has a visual basic editor in there. I know each and every corner of the 90s Word application because I taught that, and I know each and every bug from the 90s. The latest versions may be fantastic, but from what I hear, there's still the same bugs around, like, you know, that you can't get out of lists, especially if you have a nested list. Once you're in a nested list, you can get out all these things.
It's hugely buggy. I mean, I rant about Microsoft kind of on a regular basis. I mean, mostly about their irritating kind of account authentication. But I mean, having been working in a consultant's, well, there's two use cases that still kind of just irritate me enormously. One is, you know, having written a book, you know, there comes a point where, because copy editors want track changes, which we're going to get to, you know, then you're stuck. Then however you've been writing, and I write in Markdown, and I have done for many, many years, pretty much as soon as the spec came out, then you have to go into Word, or you know, you can kind of do it in Google too, but it's horrible. It's horrific. And I kind of hate it. I when I wrote my PhD, I used another app called Mellel. Back then, because I couldn't face doing a long form. It's really bad for long form writing, where it just starts chugging really well. It feels like, I always feel like I'm using an emulator, which I kind of suspect I am. Right. And the other thing is then in consulting, obviously, is the world of PowerPoint, right? And talk about the number one place where you can faff about and lose enormous amounts of time on formatting. That's the place. Now, you guys, before we get back into IA Writer, we should probably just talk about IA Presenter a little bit. So tell us about IA Presenter.
So, yeah, I haven't worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers or wherever you've been.
All right, well, it was Fjord, right? So,
and Fjord, that was part, right, yeah.
That was part
Fjord
of
used
an
to be
Accenture.
A design agency, but the Accenture.
Oh, well, that's exactly. Such a burn, but yeah, okay, yes.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know about like the insider jokes in those consultancies. As a design agency, you live in PowerPoint. I used to work at Interbrand, which is not that far away from the really bad, evil consultancies. But
Fjord, a nice guy. But yes,
very nice. No, they're very nice. Yeah, they just belong to McKinsey or what was that again?
No, they belong to Accenture. Which I would, you know, I probably would.
Yeah, I have to stop.
Not the worst. I would say. I think McKinsey are probably, you know, pretty high up there. So anyway,
I have to stop with the evil jokes. But yeah, so what is it? What is it about? You live also in PowerPoint, and especially if you work for a bigger consultancy.
Yeah.
You just make one PowerPoint after the other, and that's pretty much what I did at Interbrand. I just lived in PowerPoint. Felt like very very basic camping, actually. And then, you know, there was a phase where every web designer had to be at the design conference, and I followed the tribe. And so I was giving one presentation after the other until there was a point where I asked myself, do I really need to use PowerPoint here as well? Do I really need to have a presentation? And I started experimenting with presentations without PowerPoint, and I liked that a lot. And I remember, you know, on weddings or Christmases, when, you know, your talented uncle stands up and, you know, hits the glass and then starts talking, people paid a lot of attention. Everybody was happy and looking forward to these. And most of these conferences, I'm sorry, but most people don't really enjoy these presentations. They don't. They're just boring. And you know, they have the memes and they have the videos and so on. But there are very few people that really care about what they say. And I kind of ended my whole career at conferences, you know, because the family was starting to complain. You fly to Australia, you fly here, you fly there. Yeah. But actually, you have two kids at home and started saying no. And staying with the family. And but I ended that career more or less by sticking to non-PowerPoint presentations and just talking. Even though I was talking about design, I always have this like tendency to philosophize about design, which is the reason why I accepted also these conferences, because that gave me the opportunity to talk about Heidegger and Plato and Aristotle, which clients at the time were not so eager to hear about. And that was pretty much it. And, you know, I've been mostly working on the application for the last 10 years, except for some select clients that I still work with. And I didn't need much PowerPoint anymore. And then one of our employees started working on the Markdown version of PowerPoint quite some time ago, and developer, very, very talented, extremely talented, extremely efficient, interesting personality. And I was very skeptical. It was like, first of all, I don't like presentations, and then just, you know, making PowerPoint in Markdown is kind of pointless, and I hate that. I hate presentation apps.
Yeah,
viciously. And then, you know, he did his presentation. I didn't, you know, wasn't a big commercial success. And he said, like, yeah, but I build it. I have all this stuff. And maybe, you know, I think what is needed is some design. And he felt like making it look nice, right? And I don't take that personally.
Could you put some nice, design sprinkle on top of my code? Is that what you're?
A bit. But like I said, he's a really cool guy. He totally understands what we are actually doing. But he sort of, I think he might have. No, I'm being unfair. He knows what we're doing, and he knows that it would have probably gone a bit further. But we planned like 3 months to see what can happen if we add some design, and then these 3 months turn into 3 years, because design is not on top, it starts on the bottom. Mm. So we started asking, what is really a presentation? How should it be done? And, you know, we started researching. We went to Cicero. I don't know how to say Cicero in English. That's just something I always read in English. Cicero.
I say Cicero. Yeah.
Cicero.
Yeah.
Maybe even native speakers don't know how to say Cicero, because it's, they always Latin. Read it. And anyway, so Cicero. And all the, you know, the traditional rhetoric theory, and we found some very nice, very useful tips, like, you know, the canon of rhetorics, where you start with the idea and then you work on the structure and then you elaborate your speech and then you add detail. You try to remember it, and in the end, actio is not unimportant, that you actually, you know, you do a good speech, right? This is something you need to train and you need to focus. And all of this is completely left out in PowerPoint. You just focus on, you know, moving boxes around all the time. And so I started getting excited about it, and getting so excited that we worked on this for 3 years. until we had the structure where we say, okay, so our presentation, you start with the idea. If you have nothing to say, maybe you shouldn't do anything. You start with the idea, you write your speech. Then you add visuals where it makes sense, not because you have a slide where you need to have something. And your speech will not be something that everybody needs to see, that you put on every slide so you don't forget when you present, but it's something that only you see. So it's split between what you say and what you show is a fundamental part of it. And the fundamental part of it is also that you don't use stock imagery and stuff. So we actually have some secret functionality that we don't show. So we have Unsplash actually built into Presenter, but we never unlocked it because we feel like it would be detrimental to the idea. So we have a sort of a Protestant tendency in our company where we don't do things that would be possible. We also have hidden in the code, we have graphics, charts and graphics and so on that you could write. But we haven't unlocked it because it's not good enough. We have backlinks in IA Writer, but we haven't unlocked it because it's as good as everything else and we want to unlock it when it's better. So we've had that for 9 months now in IA Writer. We've had backlinks, but we don't unlock it because it's messy. It's nasty. And it's as good as other apps, but we feel like it's below the level of what we have in IA Writer. So that Protestant thing of, we keep it back, we could do it, but we don't, because not to make other people suffer like the Protestants. That's the Protestants' idea, right? You always have to suffer a little bit, otherwise you don't go to heaven. That's not the idea, no? But we are sometimes a bit frosty with new features, but I think it's good. So to make sure that we keep the original vision, and that brings you back to IA Writer. The vision is always that to make a tool where that is made for writing, and that means that where you enjoy writing as well.
And I
noticed lately that means where you enjoy thinking, which is almost a paradox because thinking is very painful.
I want to get onto that. I'm going to get onto this just one second. I've got a question here from Nicole. Hi, Nicole. And she asked whether it uses Reveal.js under the hood of IA Presenter.
When it comes to technical matters, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I think I heard Reveal before. I leave that to the developers, and I'm like 99% sure. But sometimes I say things technically, and they tell me no. But I'm pretty sure it's Reveal. 99%.
All right. So yeah, just to kind of finish off that, I think one of the things that we used to try and. I guess I don't know when I learned this, but it's the idea that the deck is not the presentation. And I think this is a thing in consulting that gets, conflated all the time. And for a lot of people when they're presenting, and it's partly because, you start with the deck, and, usually in consulting, you don't start with an empty deck. You go, oh, here's all this kind of other stuff that we really have. And you make a Franken deck out of all those different decks. And then, and then you're kind of stuck with all that. So let's move on to IA Writer.
Yeah.
I want to touch on the kind of thinking thing, actually. There's a designer called John Morica, who's one of Tomato. He's very, very long experienced designer. And he often said to me, he missed the times when Photoshop was machines were slower, and you'd apply a filter, blur filter in Photoshop, and go off and make a cup of coffee whilst it was doing it, chugging away the kind of blue barring, because it gave me time to think about what I wanted to do next. And so there is this, though, there is this kind of connection between writing and thinking. One of the things I learned as a writer was, keep the structural stuff. Of and that's also formatting, but also keep the structural stuff of like the outline and what you're planning to do, and editing separate from the actual act of writing, the generative thing. Because when you combine those together, and this is always my message to my students writing their thesis, it's often the first big bit of writing they've done. If you do the editing and writing at the same time, you get caught in that thing where you spend 2 hours writing the first sentence. Right? And I used to write a column for a design magazine and have to kind of knock out 1,000 words every month. And I always knew the first two or three paragraphs, they were just, I had to let myself write junk because I knew I'd go back because halfway through or towards the end, I would realize, oh yeah, now I know what I'm talking about. And actually a journalist friend of me said, gave me a tip once, so take the last paragraph you wrote, cut it and paste it at the beginning. And because at that point, you know actually what you're going to write about, and that's the introduction. So I think there is a kind of parallel there between this idea of kind of thinking and writing. And I know there will be a bunch of people who are watching this who are from the sort of PKM, personal knowledge management community, who use Obsidian. And for me, I use both, right? And the way I think about it is I use Obsidian for note-taking and for kind of for thinking and the outlining. And I use IA Writer to do the writing. If I want to do some writing, I'll use that. And that's, for me, the kind of combination of those two. One of the things that does also start to happen, though, is you kind of, as I was saying before, you sort of write to think, right? So, yes, you'll think about what you want to write, but there's a load of stuff that happens as you're writing where you start to realize, oh, you know, and then that, and oh, this is what I actually mean, and so forth, which kind of brings us to the whole AI assistant thing, right? Which is obviously part of the way you can use that is just to do the writing for you. And I'm pretty sure I read a thesis the other day that was mostly ChatGPT, hard to say. Or you can kind of use it differently. So let's go there, because you know, as you've built this into IA Writer, God, the AI and AI, IA thing is really annoying, isn't it? You must be so annoyed by that. You've kind of thought about this beyond just, oh, we're going to add this feature or we're going to add this stuff. So maybe we can talk about you and your sort of what you've been thinking about in terms of writing with AI. And you wrote several pieces actually about, you know, what is it good for and when is it useful and when is it not?
I mean, this whole notion that writing is thinking, this is just not my thought at all. This is wildly and widely shared in writing guides. William Zinsser said it just exactly like that. Writing is thinking, but I've read that in various versions. I really love to read books about writing.
And
you know, they're written under the condition that they have to show that they know what they're talking about, and that pressure often leads to good examples. You know, I think some of the best writing from Stephen King is about writing, actually, not even it's even called like that, the book. It's a great book.
Yeah, his thing was that writing is an act of telepathy, right? That's my favorite line from
that's great too. That's true.
Yeah.
But there are also various versions of this formulation, right? Mm. Writing is time traveling and so on.
Yeah.
When ChatGPT came out a year ago, I was taken by surprise how well it simulates human language at this point, right? And the big shock for me was not so much that, you know, that statistical approach actually works and simulates human thought to the point where you often are not sure, is it even understanding what it does? Because it can't. Without the body, I'm philosophically convinced you can't understand.
Yeah.
But it was shocking how well it can simulate thinking. And there were two big shocks. I tried it with some philosophical literature. We both studied philosophy. That's also something that your readers maybe, your viewers maybe know, but it's a funny coincidence that we also found out only a bit later when we talked back in the day. Now, what was shocking is how well it understands complex philosophical texts. So, you know, when you read the Critique of the Pure Reason in German, even now after almost 40 years, for me, it's really difficult. I need to fully focus, and I'm trained in the matter, but I have to fully focus, and I can consume maybe a page per hour or so when it gets really complicated. Yeah. But with ChatGPT, I can ask it, what does that mean? How does that relate to, you know, transcendental apperception or whatever? And it gives me pretty good answers. And of course, you're suspicious, and often it you know, hallucinates, but very often it's spot on and it can help you. So you if you use it as a dialogue partner to read complex texts, but just as you deal with a human dialogue partner, where you're not like, oh yeah, not that must be it, but as you know, as a dialogue partner where you discuss with the person. I used to, my best friend at university, Mirjana, was my dialogue partner back in the day. And we used to read Heidegger and all these impossible. We used to read Hegel, like the worst stuff, and it was fun in dialogue. And I can use it like that because, as you know, there are a few people, like my wife doesn't want to talk to me about philosophy. She's majorly annoyed by that waste of time. And other friends, you know, I don't know. A few people really have the desire and the background, the education and the will to discuss philosophy for many hours. ChatGPT does that. So that was a nice surprise. I have someone I can talk about the metaphysics, which is something I've been studying for 2 years now again, with great passion. And I love this book now after many, many years where I used to hate it. And with ChatGPT, I can do this. So that was a positive surprise. The negative surprise was that the bullshit you get from ChatGPT is very similar to the bullshit you get from corporations and from marketing talk and from
management
consultancies. it's almost indiscernible. And I realized that we are all less original than we think we are, because when we use language, we often use cliches and things we heard somewhere, and we forgot that we heard it and we repeat it, and we think, you know, we came up with it ourselves. We also work a lot like ChatGPT. Language works like that. However, there's one major difference. If you're really serious about communicating with other people, what you want to do is you want to transfer the impression you have inside yourself, find an expression that matches that impression as much as possible so that other people on the other side can pick up that expression and make an impression and incorporate it actually into an impression inside themselves. I think this is what's really happening when we communicate. We have something inside, something more or less vague, we call it feeling, and we try to find a shape for it, which usually is a form of language, can be visual, can be verbal, can be music, can be, you know, when we say language, we often all just think about verbal language, but this is what happens when we speak and we mean what we say. We try to find a shape for what we sense, for what we empfind, I would have almost said, and put that into a shape so other people can have the same impression. And actually dealing with ChatGPT, you know, I started thinking about this in a very, very intense way together with ChatGPT. I think my first longer conversation was if it can understand. And at first it said it can. And I almost convinced it that it can't understand because it doesn't have a body. And I tremendously enjoyed that conversation, which was slightly annoying because I didn't expect that to happen. But it made me think because I thought that this is very, very helpful in many ways for writing. It's helpful for preparation.
Yeah.
It's helpful for testing what you want to say. And then, you know, for me as a non-native speaker, it's often very, very difficult to write English and not make mistakes that I just can't see. I can't spot them. A comma's missing. Something is misspelled. And then people read this and I feel like people think I'm very stupid, but I just can't see it. And ChatGPT can always spot these mistakes. So there are many things where it's really great. But I, you know, all the downsides were very obvious to me. Like from the very start, it's going to, in fact, most people are going to use it like business consultants and just splatter the bullshit all over the place. You said you just read a paper that was very likely written with ChatGPT. We develop a sense for it like we develop a sense for you know, the visual AI, when I see this lollipop stuff, I'm not impressed at all anymore. And we start seeing it with language too, but it's much, much harder because our senses for for language are not as sharpened as our senses are for visual products, where now most people, I think, that have a little bit of training in visual perception will see 99% of AI-produced imagery and will be able to recognize that.
Yeah, I talked about it when we were talking earlier, where there's the, you know, people know the uncanny valley, this idea that, you know, a 3D rendering, or a, it comes from robotics actually, but, you know, something that's either the closer it gets to being human, it goes through that valley of like the more it's a little bit off and a bit creepy and uncanny, right? You know, that's more abstract, like an emoji or whatever, or, you know, is feels more, we're more empathetic to, then again, it has to be really super exactly human for us to kind of go back through that valley. And I'm sort of getting that quite a lot with AI imagery, but also with ChatGPT, there's just, I'm kind of reading stuff and I think at least, so this is the challenge, right? And I will get to authorship mode, is I think I'm reading it and I think I'm thinking this, you know, there's a shift in tone here and it kind of feels like this has not been written by the same person, and my suspicion is ChatGPT. And obviously when I then put in a prompt around the kind of subject matter that I'm reading and I get kind of the same text back, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm sort of 90% sure. I do worry that I'm probably missing quite a lot else. So you've built this functionality into IA Writer 7 called authorship. So tell us a bit about how that works and the kind of thinking behind it. I'm going to put the video up on screen whilst you're talking about it too.
Yeah, so, you know, this initial perception of how well it can imitate us and what it could lead to in a positive and in a negative way, you know, it strengthened more and more the idea that it's good to use ChatGPT as a dialogue partner when you don't have a human being you can talk to about things, and not everybody has an editor to work on their texts, and not everybody has 20 philosophy friends they can talk about the Critique of the Pure Reason if they want to read it outside of university. I think this is a very positive use case, but, you know, the ability to pretend that you think, to pretend that you've written, to pretend that you understand is huge, and this will be the standard use case. A lot of voices started popping up about, yeah, we need to have some sort of watermarking, some fantasies that, you know, there will be AI to recognize AI. That's such a ridiculous idea, technically. I mean, you don't need to think very hard. You know, this is just an arms race that will never be won by anyone. We thought that this sounds awfully familiar, this problem about, you know, originality and is it really you and so on. And it led back to a long, long internal discussion we had about copyright, right?
Yeah.
It's a huge, complex, delicate, difficult, dangerous topic to talk about, because you're in proximity to big corporations that use copyright and patent laws to just, you know, exercise power.
Yeah.
But it's also very, very real. If you're a graphic designer or indie developer and you see your stuff being used by these bigger corporations often that then claim copyright over it, it's a huge problem, and it's practically impossible to solve, because whenever you say something, you call someone else, you sound like a whiny little
shit
animal.
Oh, you were on YouTube. Can't say that, but there we go. Done it now.
Whiny little animal, you know, of the canine kind, and is this just some way to deal with this? Like, just from this perspective, and we usually just avoid it. But as a designer, you also know that sometimes you've stolen stuff, right? And sometimes you know that you've done things that you shouldn't have done. And I've done things I shouldn't have done plenty in my life as a designer and as a human being. And I've stolen designs that I shouldn't have. And I vividly remember these, especially one case where I really shouldn't have done, two cases actually, but I really shouldn't have done it. And I still feel very bad about it, like extremely bad, to a point where, you know, the two people that I've stolen from, they probably like, yeah, it's a long time ago and you corrected it and it's fine. One time I've been called out about this and I corrected it right away. And it was so embarrassing because I knew I stole content from another website. Mm-hmm. And the guy, you know, he came to me, he's like, you're a young man. You maybe not be fully aware of that, but this is not good, you know? And I apologized and took it down. And the other case is where I stole a design. And I really like, I ripped it off like one-to-one because it was so great. It must have been like 2006 or something. I'm not going to say exactly, but it was terrible. It was just absolutely horrific. And that stayed with me. I was like, yeah, the person you steal from kind of knows. It's not like a headache where only the person that has the headache knows. The person knows as well. But you really know. And you know you shouldn't do it. So we were like, you know what? This is the right approach for copyright. It's about the author. It's not about just about the person you steal from. It's a bad thing, sure. And the person will get offended because you steal their time. Because to design or to write something, to find a shape, takes so much time. It takes no time to copy stuff, especially in the digital realm. And so we were like, this is somewhat more connected. What if the right approach for AI also is not about, you know, policing and patrolling and trying to catch people that are using AI like, you know, you were kind of like aiming at before. It's about them. And maybe, you know, if they're not just complete assholes, they feel worse. They feel even worse. Mm-hmm. It's a very embarrassing thing to steal from other people and being caught and being called out and so on. But it's not about being called out. You feel bad to begin with. If you're an honest designer, if you're an honest person, you know, when you bullshit people, and we do that inadvertently sometimes, but when you say what you don't understand, when you say what you don't mean, if there's any humanity left in you, you feel really bad about it. And I thought, maybe this is the right angle, that we do not try to create like something that scans for ChatGPT typical expressions, because we have
to. They don't work very well anyway. You
know, it wouldn't work really well.
I've tried them and everything I put through it went 100% human. I was like, you know, this is just, I've just taken this generated from ChatGPT and it doesn't work.
You could go down this path, but you know, whenever you do something like that, there's always a countermeasure as well. But it's ethically the wrong approach. Ethically, the right approach is saying like, you have to decide for yourself. And you know, you can use ChatGPT for spelling, for grammar. Here we go again.
There you go.
For spelling, for grammar. I think, you know, editing's fine. You know, journalists have editors and they change a lot of text. Yeah. I think it's fine. You don't need to have the, you know, academic levels of scrutiny where you're not allowed to actually just, you know, transcribe a thought. But in the end, it's up to you. And as an author, you know, and so we wanted to build something like that. And we said, the main problem we have currently is that if you're an honest person, but you use ChatGPT to write in the most honest way you can, you don't want to pretend to say what you don't understand or express what you don't mean, you don't have a possibility to discern what you got from ChatGPT and what you did yourself. And then we had the technical problem. How the hell do you do this in Markdown? And now we have a solution where people are like, yes. Some people say like, oh, it's just marking off, it's no big deal. It was super hard to do. And now it's kind of obvious. So then, you know, the circle closed where we were like, holy shit, now we have that copyright problem again. Because people are going to copy it. And, you know, our friends at Obsidian, they've been just ripping off our design, like up and down, just like to the pixel, how to reconstruct iWriter and then Electron. We like the team at Obsidian, and Obsidian's great software. It does fantastic, impossible things. So my favorite function is how you can lay out stuff like in Illustrator and stuff. This is all good. But, you know, ripping off our design, it pisses me the fuck off, you know, because it's not cool. It's cool if you do it for yourself, but it's not cool if you put like entire libraries out there, like how to, You know, it's really not cool.
To be fair to the Obsidian team, though, it's not them, right? It's the plugin and kind of theme.
Oh yeah, I've talked to Capano about this when he started lauding someone, you know, for being so innovative to invent syntax highlight. I was like, dude, this is not innovative. It's just another ripoff. And he was like, yeah, I'm sorry, it's true. You know, we know. He knows the feeling because he's also a developer and he gets ripped off all the time. But it's also not an attitude, honestly, to say like, well, it's not our fault. We want to be flexible. We can actually, I think, and I'll have to talk to them again about this. I meant to do that. I think they should tell their developers, hey, please don't make clones of other indie apps, right? If you make a clone of Word, you know, you can punch up like this. But like clones of other indie apps, it's like, and you know, because we don't punch down or on the same level, but you know, Obsidian with being a free app has a pretty big audience at this point. I don't think it's punching down anymore when I say like, yes, you know, have a policy for, you know, what's cool to clone and whatnot. If it's pixel perfect cloning, like it's just not cool. It's not cool. And we haven't said anything about it until the show, but I think it's just fucking uncool, this stuff. It pisses me off. And it's also a bad clone often because what we do, you can't. It's not a native app. And you know, the degree we go to with our typography is insane. But I'm not going to get into details.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there's maybe a fair counter argument to this. I'd be interested to see what your response is because, you know, I have seen people say, well, you know, I like this bit, but I don't like all the rest. And I don't want to be, because I think it's probably fair to say, and I think you were kind of one of the sort of early, I mean, you said it at the beginning, but also sort of one of the early voices of the idea of kind of opinionated app design, right? Where, you know, IA writer has, there's opinion in there, right? There's a lot of detailed thought and design philosophy that goes into it. And it's not going to be for everyone, right? And right down to, you know, whether you show the markdown or whether you don't and all that kind of stuff. These are decisions I know you've thought long and hard about. I don't think they're not, you know, random. But I was thinking of the German word, willkürlich, and I can't think what the English word of that is.
I think random is pretty close.
And, but at the same time, you know, people might go, well, you know, I really kind of like the focus mode, but I kind of don't really want all the rest. Or, you know, the other stuff, the way you handle the kind of markup is not for me or whatever. Do you think that it's fair then? Or are you going to, would your answer be, well, yeah, sure, do it for yourself then. Write a kind of little CSS snippet for yourself to enable that. But is your point really, it's not that, it's actually the whole constellation of sort of trying to kind of customize and use a whole bunch of plugins and CSS to try and sort of completely clone the exact look and feel within an app.
I have absolutely no problem whatsoever. You can do, you know, you can clone anything you want for yourself. If you do it for yourself privately, I do that all the time. You learn a lot, it's great. And maybe, you know, there's a particular person that's like, oh, you know, the bold needs to be gray. We have, like you say, we have a good reason why we don't do that. And we just say no. We thought about this long and hard, and typography is kind of something. Yeah, you know, we're very opinionated in a way, but we also know what the hell we're doing there. And so yeah, if that is so important for you, you can replicate that in whatever app you want. That's fine. If you do things for yourself, it's totally fine. Yeah. What I think is absolutely horrendous is to make full packages that allow you, everyone, to clone our apps, you know, functionally, design-wise, down to the pixel, which actually is not possible anyway, down to the pixel in another free app. This is totally uncool. And, you know, people thinking like, oh, yeah, it will be free advertisement for you or something. Fuck off. No, we don't need free advertisement. We're doing fine. That's not the point. It's about stealing someone's design and make it available for everyone. It's called counterfeiting. And, you know, if you want to, it's illegal, but that's not the point. It pisses us off because it's our work and you're not supposed to distribute it freely to everyone. Now, if you're not happy with a certain way that we design our app and you want pretty much everything that we have except for, like some like asterisks that want to be gray, well, do what you can, you know, and rebuild the app in Xcode. If you want the native feeling, you know, no, I'm not going to provoke people now with this.
No, but, no.
It's fine. It's fine. The problem we have is the and we didn't realize that for a long time because, like I said, usually we stay silent, don't say anything. And actually, these plugins are not even that. They're not even that popular, you know. And they're being left there and they decay. And it's not a big commercial problem for us. It's not. It just pisses me off because the attitude is the wrong one.
Yeah.
This is not something you can just take and distribute freely to other people. It's not yours.
You have bigger problems in the App Store though with things like AI Writer and things using your logo and everything, you know, and just kind of switching the letters around.
It's not a commercial problem. Look, we've sold 3 million apps in 13 years. We have 500,000 users. Everyone has paid our app.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, we have made some experiments with like a free tier on Android. It was an absolute disaster. It attracts completely the wrong people for the type of app we have.
Yeah.
Anyway, the last word on opinionated. I hate that word.
And I thought you might.
And the problem is I'm not a native speaker, so I don't have so many context for the word opinionated. The only time where I hear opinionated, it's negative. And I know it's been used.
No, it gets used positively quite a lot. Yeah.
People have been trying to use this in a positive way, but every time people say opinionate, I'm like, no, it's not opinionate.
No, I think
I have opinions, but you know, it's not. We don't do that because we think our way is the only right way, and you have to follow because we.
Yeah, but that's the idea. I mean, when people talk about an opinionated app, what they're saying is, this is my opinion. I mean, the. Is it Logsec? I think it's that one, which you know it takes that view as well. Which is, you know, this is the approach I'm going to take to this. I have opinions about the, you know, the style or the, you know, the mental model or the UX or whatever it is about this, and I'm going to sort of apply those to the thing I'm making, which is fair enough, right? I'm making a thing, and you have to have an opinion, right? The worst way is down the other end. I think where you get the sort of design by committee, a lot of enterprise software is like this, and a lot of open source stuff is like this actually, where it's kind of opinion less and it's kind of generally really watered down or kind of incoherent and inconsistent because of this, I think. So, you know, for my view, I think you have to have an opinion about we're going to choose this because an opinion helps you make a choice, right? It's a filter. It says we're going to do this instead of this because our underlying philosophy is you know is based around that. So that's what I mean by that. But I want to get back to this idea of interoperability because partly it's in my head because I've been listening to and reading Cory Doctorow's the Internet Con, you know, and the heart of it is this idea of interoperability or of avoiding it, you know, and that's what big tech has done, is obviously it's tried to
see it going on
with the kind of federated thing at the moment, you know. Tried to avoid interoperability, and you know, in order to create these huge kind of walled gardens and monopolies. And so, one of the things, one of the things that authorship mode does in IA Writer is when you're pasting stuff in, it will keep a reference of like what you've pasted and who the author is of that stuff. Which for me is great because one of the things that happens, I find, when I'm working with other people is we lose track of who wrote what, you know. And as you mentioned in the article, you know, track changes in Word or using diff. I know there's a school of working or writing which uses Git for writing. It's pretty kind of horrendous, really, in the end, as a kind of user experience. And so you've come up with this approach to do this. And so and in it, you sort of grade out stuff so that gradually you kind of, as you rewrite the AI written stuff or the other author's written stuff, it kind of turns black. And so you get the sense of how much is yours and how much is written by someone or something else. But you've also released this as on GitHub as markdown annotations. So given the conversation around, you know, features and not being ripped off and so forth, Why release this as a you know open source or as a spec?
So this was a heated debate. This is a heated debate because we also run a business. We do, right? And you know the first thing that happens when we do something new is we get ripped off like regularly. And I know how whiny and how you know little animal this sounds, but it's a reality. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And you don't know, you have no idea how much it happens because we never say anything. But we see all this mostly because people report that. When we came out with IA Right, we had different mails every day.
Yeah.
Of people pointing to this and then the other. And you develop a thick skin, but it's also annoying. And then from a business perspective, now it would have been much cleverer to just keep this for some time until someone copies it or copies something similar, and then it's not interoperable anymore.
Yeah.
But the reason why we like Markdown most of all is because of its interoperability. It's fantastic. I copy paste stuff all the time. And this is something that a lot of people don't understand about Markdown, because they're like, oh, can you have an export here, an export there? But actually, it's about copy and pasting stuff. I copy and paste it from IA Writing to WordPress, to ChatGPT and back. And it always works. Also, ChatGPT uses Markdown. It's fantastic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really cool. This interoperability is fantastic. So we were like, okay, so there's the interoperability aspect where we can't just ignore this. And rather than people doing something similar, but then it's not compatible anymore, we should actually publish it. And then there's the other aspect where we say like, well, authorship, it's up to you. You need to decide. So we said, so why don't we formulate it like that? Well, it's not something clear cut like the legal texts. And like I said, it's not about legality when we talk about copyright. It's about morality. And it's not clear cut. You can do this, but not that. And the other thing, because design doesn't work like that. Design, when you copy design, you know it. And the copy person kind of knows it as well. So we said let's do it like that. You can use the functionality just as it is. Well, if you can help us developing it, and we got a lot of really great feedback on that as well, and we will develop it based on that feedback, which is fantastic. We didn't expect that, because usually when you do something open source, you don't get much feedback. Just people just use it and that's it. We've seen that with the fonts, right? Anyway, I don't want to complain too much. What we want is people to use this and do their own thing with that. And if they do their own thing, it's fantastic. And it's completely up to them. And that doesn't mean you can abuse it and just say you serve yourself to me so I can cheat. That's really not the idea. It's they have to get into the reality of the creative business, where you need to find a way with yourself to come to peace with how much you copy and how much you don't. And mm-hmm. then you need to live with it. That's our take. And we're not going to call out people. I'm not saying categorically not calling out people, because if you go too far, you go too far. But we reserve the freedom to say something if it's just ridiculous, right? But very likely we're not going to say anything, even though we don't agree. It's up to you.
Yeah.
The thing though is, if you're not sure, you can always talk to us. And that's also, a reality that few people grab, that when they do something and they're not sure, will this piss off the other person? They talk to you. And I always appreciate that.
But I think, to sort of end up with that, I'm really pleased you have released it, because I find the interoperability part is the kind of the critical bit of plain text and Markdown, right? The whole fact that you can, plain text is very robust. There was a little sort of conversation about it on Mastodon. You can have several apps open at the same time, accessing the same plain text file. And even when they're auto-saving, most of the time, they don't clash with each other. And obviously just kind of move from one side to the next for whatever you're doing.
However, it's not very realistic that this is going to be a standard or something.
Well, I hope it is. I mean,
people are going to use it. I'm not very hopeful on that.
You're not hopeful. I am.
No, it's more of a...
Because the perennial kind of pain for anyone who's writing and having to collaboratively write, and like I said, and you've got an editor and stuff, is like at some point having to go back into Word or Google for track changes. I know there's critic markup. I've had a go. Maybe if I was a proofreader, a bit like the way proofreaders know all those little symbols, they used to kind of write on a manuscript by hand, you kind of remember all the markup. I just found it too much for me to kind of remember at the time. And I kind of really liked this as an approach. So I hope it does, because I really want the sort of collaborative markdown writing tool that doesn't involve some kind of weird gymnastics going between, you know, putting stuff up onto Google and then exporting again. And I've tried it, and none of it ever works. Even there's a sort of Etherpad kind of plugin for Obsidian that sort of attempts that, but it doesn't really work. So that's the holy grail for me. And so I hope that does. I hope it does become a standard. Hey, we're coming up for time. Where can people find you online? Are you basically on IANet?
Yeah. I moved away completely from Twitter. We have some, you know, bad conscience tweets here and there sometimes, because we think like, yeah, few good people that are still left on Twitter, and there are some good people still left. You know, yeah, this is, by the way, what we did, but we'll move completely over to saying, subscribe to our newsletter or come to Mastodon, where I am right now. I think I feel very comfortable on Mastodon. Mm-hmm. We are at some instance on Mastodon and Reichenstein at Mastodon. What I used to do on Twitter, now we do on there. It's great. The audience is perfect for indie developers and for people that think alike. Still, one more last word about this, about, you know, whether it becomes a standard or not. I've been dragged into that word, you know, being forced to use word again and again myself. I'm not naive. I know what the standard defines. It's the most used apps, Google Docs, after Word. But I think it's really important that we do what we say and that we act accordingly. And so putting this out there, you know, there's a little hope that, you know, more people will pick this up and, you know, we would be able to use authorship in different places. But mostly we have to offer the possibility to do that. And we have to stay true to what we say about authorship and copyright, and, you know, allow people to make their own decisions in that way. And if we said, like, no, this is our standard, you can only use it here, it may be profitable short term, but it won't be very useful. What we did instead is we tried as much as possible to look at this back and forth. You know, if you copy a text in that is different, you can say, where does it come from? And we spend a lot of time on that as well. But if other people use it and evolve it and find another shape of it, maybe even a better one, where we would be tempted to, you know, copy and improve it, because that's what creativity is. You copy and improve to a point where you don't necessarily recognize the original at one side. Then that would be really, really cool. Yeah. So,
but it would be nice. I think one of the, you know, the gifts to the world of John Gruber was to kind of not try and sort of own the Markdown spec, especially as there's been, you know, other variants of it, and there's all sorts of different kind of flavors of it now. And, you know, and he's kind of resisted a lot of pressure to kind of change his kind of original spec. It's like, you know, this is the spec. If you're going to go off and do something else, and go off and doing something else. But, you know, I think he's changed one thing. I can't remember which one it was. I don't know if it's images or footnotes. I don't think footnotes are in the original spec. And it's become this great thing that's kind of everywhere, even in ChatGPT. So the show, Power of 10, it's named after the Ray and Charles Eames film. It's called Powers of 10. And it's about the relative size of things in the universe. And I've always really liked it for that kind of different levels of mental zoom and the sort of repeated patterns at different phases. So on that front, the final question is always, what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
Wow, I never watched your show, which I should. Then I would have known this. One thing that I don't think it's a little thing, but one thing I notice is the trash can. You know, we separate the trash. We have organic trash and plastic bottles and cardboard, and we have like a big box now of different trash elements, and we do our best to separate that. And yet, for some reason, whenever I look at my trash can, I feel like, what a bunch of evil people are we? You know, every time I look at my trash can, I'm like, yeah, you're not trying as hard as you can, because there's still too much stuff in there. It still fills up too quickly. And I wonder, I don't know how, I don't have a solution, but I wonder if someone could have a look at this and, you know, find a way to redesign the trash can in a clever way that it helps us to not fill it up so quickly with all kinds of crap. My brain starts working already on it.
Yeah,
I think about labels. I think about making it smaller or whatever, but making a smaller opening. I'm not sure. But I think this would change a lot because we still throw away way too much stuff.
I'm looking forward to the IA trash can. You've got these beautiful notebooks you just made. We didn't even talk about those. I'm looking forward to getting my hands on one of those too. Oliver, thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Thank you as well. It was a pleasure.
You have been listening to and watching Power of 10. You can find more about the show at polaine.com, polaine.com, where you can also check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, as well as sign up for my pretty irregular newsletter, Doctor's Note, although I will be doing an end of year one. If you have any thoughts, you can put them in the comments below. If you're on YouTube, you can find me at apolaine, apolaine, and on pkm.social on Mastodon. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.